Good morning and welcome to this morning's chapel. Let's begin the chapel this morning singing together in the blue hymnal number 105. Christ, we do all adore thee, and please stand for this opening song.
Good morning. I'm Mike Medley, Chair of the Language and Literature Department, and I'm pleased to welcome you to chapel this morning to hear Dr. Mark Bauerlein. The Department of Language and Literature invited Mark to EMU to be part of our Writers Read series and to provide input on a conversation that we've been having here at EMU this academic year on the ways that the internet and digital media influence our behaviors, our reading, our research, and our thinking. Now, although I fully share Mark's concern that digital media used obsessively for social purposes entertainment is a significant problem for education and especially for the humanities, it was through the internet that I became introduced to Mark's book, The Dumbest Generation, How the Digital Age Stupefies Young Americans and Jeopardizes Our Future, or Don't Trust Anyone Under 30. It's a book that I highly recommend to you, even if you feel offended by the title. Maybe that's all the more reason you need to buy the book. And you can get it as you leave chapel for a mere $10, is that right? Mere $10 at the rear of the auditorium. But before reading this book that Mark has written, the internet also helped me to get acquainted with him. I found out that he's a professor of English at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. I learned that he's given some years of his life to public service as an assistant director for research in the National Endowment for the Arts during part of the George W. Bush administration. And in addition to the scholarly publications that he's done in his field, which is American literature, he's also a prolific essayist whose work has appeared in a number of prestigious journals, including the Chronicle of Higher Education, The Wall Street Journal, The Weekly Standard, The Washington Post, and First Things, a prominent journal of religion and public life for which Mark serves as a senior editor. It's actually one of those pieces in First Things that clinched my decision to invite Mark to EMU, and that was an essay entitled My Failed Atheism. And this morning, he'll touch on some of the themes from that essay in a presentation that we've entitled From Atheism to Catholicism. Please welcome Mark Bauerlein.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. And I'm happy to be here. Last night, over dinner, the faculty, we went out, six of us, and had dinner, and it was a restaurant down in Harrisonburg, and we actually said a blessing before eating, and that was the first occasion in dozens and dozens of campus visits and campus events that I've done at schools across the country where we actually did that in a public place. So I found that actually very gratifying, and so it's really something that I want to talk to you about, the world of higher education that I have been in for all my life, most of my adult life, and how that does bear upon issues of atheism. It is, except for at religious colleges, it is a not a militantly atheist world, but certainly a militantly secular world with a lot of atheism fueling it. And for a lot of my colleagues across the country, religious faith is, well, for some of them it's a dangerous thing. For others it's just a strange, odd. It's something they don't quite understand. In just in the last few months, I've had a few conversations. I was doing some work for ETS, the testing service, and a group of academics were there at their campus in Princeton, and we went out to dinner, and I've been part of this group for several years, and someone said, what are you doing? How'd you get here? It was a long flight from Atlanta. I said, no, I just took the train down from New York. I'm doing some work up there. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, I'm working for this magazine, First Things. What is it? I said, it's a magazine of religion and culture. And he said, what? And I said, religion and culture, mostly Christian, mostly Catholic, although we want to be broader than just being known as a Catholic monthly. And he kind of just screwed up his face in this incomprehension. What are you doing? And I said, well, I'm a Christian. And he said, you are? it was just strange. And he couldn't get his mind around that. And we sort of talked, and he said, you know, I find that a lot of people are sort of becoming more issues of faith are coming into play. And I said, yeah, I think it's true. I think actually 10 or 15 years ago in academia, one could just ridicule and mock and laugh off faith, Christian or other kinds. And I think something is actually changing along those lines. But in another conversation, but he wasn't sure. And this was a very distinguished scholar. He wasn't sure what that was. Another man in a conversation I had last summer when I told him, yeah, I used to be an atheist for a long, long time, and I'm not anymore. And he said, you know, I can't even conceive of what it would be like to believe in something beyond just this right here and human beings. And it really was a confession of, I don't understand this. He wasn't you have different kinds of atheists out there in the world. There's the urbane atheist, the sophisticated cosmopolitan atheist who sort of rises above all these little petty sectarian differences and is having a broader historical and philosophical perspective on things, and is cultivated, isn't against religion so much as long as religion doesn't get too politically powerful. You've got the political atheist on the order of Karl Marx and his followers, who says that religion is a political instrument, the church is a political institution, and that it must be fought as vigilantly as possible whenever it gets too politically strong. You've got the scientific atheist. The scientific atheist says that science is on a pathway of curing humanity of superstitions of various kinds, and religion is a form of superstition. And a lot of these, the new atheists like Richard Dawkins is an example. Now, the scientific atheist can be very, very hostile, as Dawkins and some of his followers are. Although I heard an example on the radio the other day of a scientific atheist who wasn't so much hostile. She was just asserting a scientific dogma as being anti-religious. It was really based upon this, she was an astronomer on the radio, and it was based upon her response to a Wall Street Journal editorial that came out about a month ago by Eric Metaxas, maybe some of you saw this, about life on other planets, and how in the last 40 years, the predictions of life, extraterrestrial, intelligent life in the universe, those predictions were actually very high. And there were even government projects who said that the odds are very good that we are going to discover alien life. And so there are government projects and personally privately funded projects monitoring space for any signals that would signify intelligence operating. Well, for 40 years, we've been disappointed. It hasn't happened. And the science has progressively shown that the odds keep going way, way down for there being any other life on in the universe, intelligent life besides us. Now, this wasn't just saying this proves God exists. The point there was to say that a certain kind of scientific atheism, which says if we find life on other planets, that's going to hinder our religious faith. Well, okay, even if we accept that, the empirical evidence hasn't followed. Well, this astronomer was on, and she just simply ignored that and said, we're going to find this. And she said, she repeated it twice at the end. She said, because it's very simple. We're not special. Us human beings on this little tiny planet in this vast universe, and this is how she put it, we're not special. Well, my response to her said, I would be, well, even in your terms, so far, we are special. Until we get the evidence, you can't say that and be a scientist. So so there's the scientific atheist right there. You also have what might be called the philosophical atheist. This is Nietzsche would be the most famous example of that. And that really was the kind of atheist that I turned into when I was 17 years old. I just one morning went outside. I kind of had a vague belief in God and in spirit or a supreme being of some kind. I'd been baptized as a Catholic, but my parents got all caught up in the 60s, and so our religious, you know, my brothers and my religious training stopped. My sister continued in Catholic school for a few years, but she drifted as well. But, you know, one morning, it was just this experience. I don't know why it happened that morning or what. I just kind of looked outside and said, there's nothing. There's nothing there. And that's really as far as it went. I just meant there's nothing spiritual out there in those trees. There's nothing divine in the sky or in the clouds. It's just empty. Okay? The world is amoral. It's vacuous. There are no supernatural beings. There are no spiritual beings either. There's nothing there. That's it. And that actually prompted me to read a lot of Nietzsche and Freud and 20th century existentialist philosophers that would reinforce this feeling of nothingness all around. And that lasted for about 35 years, for almost 40 years, about 35 years, in fact. And so I understood when the colleagues of mine, when I would say that, oh yeah, I was an atheist, but now I believe, and I'm working into the church. I've got to the Catholic Church. They set up roadblocks. They have these rules. I mean, I had some things that had to be, you know, taken care of. It took 18 months for one of them to be taken care of. But it went well. But I'm still in the process of moving toward my first communion. But I understand when the atheist says, "What, you believe in God?" There's this gap of comprehension. It's not like the kind of question where it's not a values question whereby, well, is this program a good thing? Is this helping people or not? What's the weather going to be like tomorrow? It's not something that can be crossed that this divide between the atheist and the believer, it can't, there's no common understanding that can happen there, because when I suddenly felt there's nothing, that was just this deep, inexplicable, not even rational sense of what the world is, what exists, what is there or not there. You know, I look in the woods and I see there's nothing there. You know, William Wordsworth, the romantic poet, looks in the woods and says, there is a spirit in the woods. And even if it's anything animating the objects out there, he can sense, I can't. So we can't talk. We can't discuss it. We can't debate. For my colleagues, the existence of God, that's not something up for discussion. You either do or you don't. And those who do, I mean, we have discussions. I'm talking about this kind of world where secularism, in many ways, atheism prevails so much, that would be like for them to say God exists, that would be comparable to saying, you know, is this a microphone or not? And so the conversation, it just halts. And I'm not offended by them feeling that way, again, because I understand that. It didn't register with me in any way that God could exist. What actually changed me was my son having a child. I think this isn't uncommon for people to have children. And the presence of children starts shaking up your understanding of things. When you're dead tired and you've got to go get on a plane at 9 o'clock in the morning, and your son in the next room starts crying and it's 1 a.m, you don't matter. Suddenly that shakes up. You just do what you have to do. It shakes up your a deep understanding of what the world is about and what you are. And he started asking me these questions that are not uncommon for 4 and 5, 6 year olds about God, about the universe. You know, these grand 4 year olds, grand metaphysical questions pop into their head. So, you know, at one time he said, Dad, where's God? And I could have said, God isn't anywhere. Grow up. I don't know. I couldn't say that. I remember one time he said, Dad, where's God? And he says, is God in my elbow? So, you know, something just clicked with me and said, yes, God's there and God's everywhere. We were in church. I started going around with him and his faith, his natural disposition to experience God, to feel God, to wonder about God. And God, he came so naturally to believing in God and spiritual things. And so we went to a few churches, and we were in a Catholic church for the first time. We're in a Catholic church in Princeton, New Jersey. Not, it was a Catholic service in the big Princeton chapel there. And it is actually a grand chapel. It's got all the things about, you know, the old churches with all the elevation and the stained glass windows. And you had it was a Catholic service, so you had for him people in colorful robes and candles and some smoke while walking in, and he's looking up at the roof and the windows. It did what it was, you know, the Catholic ritual did what it was supposed to do. It elevated his mind, and he was absorbed in it. And when they line up for communion, he says, Dad, I want to go, come on. I said, no, you can't. I said, Dad! You know, and he wanted to be part of that. And I took that seriously. I took it to heart. I said that this is a natural human impulse. Something is coming from deep within him. And I'm not going to call it childish. I'm not going to regarded as ignorant. And so what I did was I started going. I started meeting some Catholics and went through the Catholic Catechism. This was 3 or 4 years ago when I started going through the Catholic Catechism every week. And I found that the Catechism was just as respectable philosophically. It was just as sophisticated and intellectual as a lot of that stuff I'd been reading in my graduate seminars when I was getting a doctorate in English and reading philosophy. I said, these people are working through the same issues, and I never got exposed to any of this. No, I mean, we were reading Michel Foucault and Jacques Derrida and Karl Marx and Freud. Freud was at his worst when talking about religion, but this was taken seriously as the wisdom of modernity, and I was surprised, and I thought, this is a serious body of thought here. And so I simply do take it seriously and go to Mass and keep working through the materials and heading my way into the church. And the thing is, you just have to accept my colleagues feel a little bit of embarrassment whenever this comes up. I don't. It's funny, they're the ones who don't quite know what to say. One of my colleagues at Emory, who died a few years ago, Betsy Fox Genovese, she had a conversion as well in the late 90s. I think she began as a Marxist historian, and she eventually made her way into the Catholic Church. And she has an eloquent essay called A Conversion Story, where she does talk about being an academic and how her colleagues, even though she was very well-known feminist, she did the great betrayal of women's studies departments. She went pro-life, and they never forgave her for that. They hated her and vilified her for being pro-life. I mean, they ran her out of women's studies at Emory University. In fact, people said, you cannot be a women's studies professor if you aren't pro-choice. That was the litmus test. Well, Betsy became a devout Catholic, and she observed the church's teachings on life issues. But in this essay, she said, my colleagues don't say anything to me about it. I presume that either they can't understand it or they simply regard it as my irrational response to some difficult times that I have had. You know, so be it. I will say that I don't think there's any convincing the academic atheist otherwise. I actually don't think those of us who are believers on this ground will ever get any justice from them in terms of acknowledging our faith as something to take seriously intellectually. They'll take it seriously on other grounds, but they won't take it seriously as an intellectual, reasonable-based position. Okay, no, I'm not going to argue that, except to proceed and make good arguments on other issues on religious Christian grounds. That's where it is. It creates a certain alienation or estrangement, not unpleasant, but just intellectually a distance. And that's what you accept from your colleagues in the secular universities out there. So anyway, I'll stop, and we'll keep talking afterwards. And I'll be standing outside afterwards if people want to discuss further.